This is a CNA podcast.
This is the Heart of the Matter. I'm Jamie Ho, and this week we're talking about the Wuhan virus, or the novel coronavirus. It's dominated headlines and bulletins. We've seen the number of cases grow in China. We've seen the virus land in country after country. Many have imposed travel restrictions on Chinese nationals and travelers from Hubei. The virus was first identified in the city of Wuhan very late last year and has since infected thousands worldwide. Today is Thursday, the 30th of January, and numbers out of China are now nearing 8,000 and deaths at 170. How concerned should we be? How better should we understand the virus? What can we do as individuals to minimize the risk of catching it? With me today are Dr. Lo Yingru, Head of Mission and World Health Organization Representative to Malaysia, Brunei and Singapore, Professor Leo Yee Sin, Executive Director of the National Center of Infectious Diseases, and Professor Dale Fisher, Senior Consultant at the Division of Infectious Diseases at NUH, and he's also Chair of the Global Outbreak and Alert Response Network. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining me. I wanted to start this conversation by perhaps setting a little bit of context to our discussions and to concerns that people may have about the Wuhan flu. And you see a lot of comparisons with SARS, for example. But can we place Wuhan flu, as we know now, between, let's say, a very virulent form of a seasonal flu that you see every now and then, not just in Singapore, but worldwide, and SARS in terms of its infectiousness, its ability to transmit, as well as its fatality/mortality rates? How concerned are we now in comparison? Professor Leo, maybe you.
Well, I would say that this is a new situation and it's evolving very quickly. And certainly we notice that the general public's knowledge about these circulations of new virus has been pretty high in the local setting. Now, coming back to your questions in terms of where do we put this virus in comparison to influenza as well as SARS, I think this is still an evolving situation, still a very new virus. There is not a lot of very clear information at this point in time for us to do a very accurate and confident comparisons between the two. There is still a lot of room to understand this virus.
Is the uncertainty behind it? A lot of what is actually driving the fear as well, in that within the community that they still don't know, and that's why that's driving a bit of the urgency in the action. Is that your sense?
Yes, I think that is not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. I actually feel that having this concern and having some degree of fear is not really a bad thing, because if you are alerted, if you do have a sense of fear and urgency, people tend to do something to protect themselves. They tend to be more alert in terms of the information coming out. They tend to want to protect themselves as well their family. So I don't think it's really a bad thing.
Okay. Dr. Fisher, you've looked at these outbreaks as a matter of course. Looking at the situation now in terms of how it's been transmitted, how concerned are you?
The point is there's still a lot we don't know. We don't really know how it's transmitted. It's a little strange that it seems like so much transmission in China. We believe it's community spread, all but a handful of cases outside of China.
So far.
True. Most haven't transmitted it at all. Mm-hmm. So we can hypothesize how it's transmitted. And certainly, as you'd know through SARS and also MERS, there were super spreaders. So in fact, most people didn't spread, but every now and then there would be someone who would spread it quite a bit. This is perhaps one of the main theories why it might be so different in China, because perhaps a super spreader hasn't actually
emerged.
That's actually
looking at how it's the news has come out of it last week or so, it's quite interesting that, as you say, almost everyone has come from Wuhan. Fortunately, you haven't seen that much community spread, and you haven't found or there isn't that super spreader scenario. Does that frame our understanding of the virus as it stands now?
It's a working hypothesis to explain what we're seeing, but until we really understand more about the epidemiology, either by understanding more about the China cases or learning from, as cases are exported, understanding the epidemiology through those. But of course, that's still under 100, still need more cases to really learn from them.
If we could talk about the incubation period as well, because that also drives a lot of the fear as well as uncertainty. You hear sometimes 14 days is sort of like the understood benchmark, but you're seeing news that's emerging as well is that it could be less than 14 days, it could be 5 days. Explain for us, what's the difference between 5 and 14 when it comes to people's then understanding of how to deal with it? Professor Leo?
Well, again, this is pretty much an epidemiological study to find out from the time of exposure to the time the person persons develop symptoms, there will be the incubation period. In general, I see a lot of reports from different parts of the world suggesting somewhere around maybe 5 days, maybe 7 days or so. But I think the reason why in a local setting we are using 14 days, basically because we just want to be very sure that we don't miss these incubation periods and give us this ability to be able to widen the net for us to be able to identify potential exposure that potentially could be infected or what we call a suspect case.
Are you also concerned about the potential that people can transmit that when they're asymptomatic?
I think this part of it, I've seen quite a fair bit of suggestions, I would say, at this point in time.
Still suggestions.
That a person may be able to transmit the virus during incubation period. I would say that, you know, at this point, we still need to wait for more information, clearer data for us to be able to confidently conclude that point. I think I would also like to hear from Yingru as well in terms of the WHO information at this point.
To bring Yingru into this as well, I've been quite impressed in a way as to how countries far and wide have been able to quite definitively confirm cases to say that this is Wuhan flu, because that helps a lot in reporting and in countries taking immediate action. Could you explain a little bit about the WHO's perspective and its approach to it so far? I'm not sure whether it has declared it a PHEIC, public health emergency of concern. Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful. Bring us back to the perspective from there and what the WHO is looking at in terms of China, in terms of travel advisories, in terms of evacuations and things like that.
You may have seen in the news that WHO Director General has convened the emergency committee twice last week, and it will be convening today, in fact, again, to make an informed decision whether or not to declare a public health emergency of international concern. So last week was not at this stage. We are looking forward to hear about that today. But what I would like also to emphasize, and coming back to the previous comments, is that since the outbreak of SARS in 2003, we have learned a lot. It was a major national crisis in Singapore, in many countries, actually, and it has resulted in significant investment. So what is different is that we have in place an international system supported by all countries for rapid sharing of information. I think you must admit that's different from 2003.
Yeah, exactly.
In 2003, we didn't find cases until much, much later, and we didn't have a test. So I think this time, cases are detected very early because of national authorities in China having shared the sequences and there's tests available. So I think that's a major difference. All the information WHO gets is actually immediately shared on the web in a way that it's understandable to the public. But then we are also working, and Dale is one of our close partners, we are working with many, many experts to inform any WHO's decisions.
If I could talk about the public health emergency sort of declaration. Explain for us what actually happens. Let's say WHO says that this is it. This is a public health emergency of international concern. What does it actually mean for the day-to-day decisions that national jurisdictions will have to take? Go back to the point about the public health emergency declaration.
Yeah. So there is a booklet which is called International Health Regulations from 2005, and it provides criteria when WHO convenes the emergency committee, and the criteria to be discussed as being when a public health emergency is declared. And this emergency committee consists of content experts and public health experts. These experts, the list of names is publicly available. They are appointed as advisors to the Director General, and they make an informed decision by presentation from the countries affected. But before that happens, of course, the government of the respective country is being consulted whether they agree to present and have that data discussed. And the China government has agreed very quickly. They have presented their data, and other governments are also invited. So this expert committee makes a decision, and this decision was not easy to take. There are a lot of different opinions. So the expert committee does not base its opinion on one single individual opinion, but on an analysis of discussions and data, which are provided by a wide range of experts.
Yixin, is this something that national jurisdictions look out for in terms of a signal as to how differently you should approach the virus? Or is that something which is supplementary to national jurisdictions? You sort of already have your own plans in place? Or does the WHO declaration actually mean a step up for us in Singapore?
Well, we do have system in place in Singapore, and it is a measured one. Progressively, you can see that the policy changes. corresponding to the situations that we can sense in the global situations. But we always look towards WHO in terms of the guidance, in terms of the information that they have to guide the entire world in terms of what we will do. So we do correspond to many of the recommendations and guidance from WHO.
I mean, that's a good point because our audience as well, and I'll just give a hint to Yingru here, we had news this morning about your DG making new comments as well in terms of the fears about community spread, and the audience really was taken by it. We had huge figures of people interested in reading about WHO perspective. So in a sense, yes, I agree, audiences and not just governments really look forward to what the WHO has to say. But if I can just talk about also, as part of the international efforts, the good news, I suppose, definitely, about vaccines, about being able to recreate the virus. Dale, maybe you can chip in here. Give us some sense of how the international community, in your eyes, has sort of been able to move. To my amateur mind, seems quite quick, seems quite optimistic. What more can you think are the sort of key landmarks here in terms of what you're looking for, in terms of the international ability to first deal with it and then find a vaccine and then start seeing cases sort of tail down? What sort of timelines?
There will be a vaccine. There's work being done on it now, but we wouldn't expect that for months. That does take time. We will see local transmission in Singapore. It would be remarkable if it didn't happen. So I don't think people should be too surprised when that happens. We still don't know yet whether it will be more like a flu model where there's community transmission. SARS, there wasn't community transmission of significance. You know, that was very much amplified in hospitals. So we knew that by bringing in the infection control measures in hospitals, we could actually control it. Whereas if it's community transmitted, then we can't control it with the same measures. Then we really rely on the community to deal with it. And perhaps in those scenarios, the best thing we could hope for, which we did, I think, remarkably well in H1N1, was to just keep that epidemiologic curve flat. So you can see what's happening in Wuhan on the news, at least, is that they need reinforcements for their health system. There's large numbers of sick people at the same time. And it's much better if we can stagger that. So maybe the outbreak might go for longer, but it's not as so many people affected at the same time. And that would be when we go from a containment phase to a mitigation phase.
Can I just add on to what Dale had just mentioned about vaccine? I think vaccine development certainly will take some time to happen. And of course, you have to go through several safety precaution measures before we can implement it in a massive way. So it will take some time to actualize that. I just want to come back to the point that if there is vaccines available to a particular conditions and it's an effective vaccine, then it will be the best public health prevention measure, that is to utilize vaccine. In these situations, it is very new and we are still trying to grapple more information about this virus. Vaccines will take a while to come. I still want to focus on the point in terms of prevention. How can we continue to prevent the potential spread of this virus, human to human or to a wider geographical distributions? So I think this is not just one country issues, but this is a global issues, because in every areas, either regional, international, we all have to put in effort to prevent human to human transmissions or prevent further transmissions of this virus. And then each one of us will stand a better chance in terms of international collaborations to prevent the transmissions in every part of the world.
That's a good point, because I also want to get maybe Dale's take and Yingru's take as well as how they have assessed China's ability to contain it so far, both in terms of reporting it firstly, and then you see news that they're building new facilities and that kind of speed that they're talking about. And some of the measures, I imagine people in the international community would think that's kind of unprecedented, their ability to lock down a city and things like that. What's the WHO take on that?
Our Director General, Dr. Tedros, and the Regional Director, Dr. Kazai, they were in Beijing just a few days ago. What I understand is that the government of China has taken measures which it believes are effective. This kind of containment hasn't been done in science before, so we don't have data, and it would be interesting to see if it works how it works and have data available. But as you said before, Dale and Yixing, there are very many unknowns, so it's good that the China government agrees to invite a team of international experts to work together with their scientists to conduct very thorough epidemiological investigations so that we better understand how this virus behaves, how it's transmitted during incubation, what's the incubation period, who is spreading and what in circumstances. So this will help us to advance very quickly.
You also see, besides China, other countries taking measures in different stages at different speeds, whether it is travel restrictions, You see airlines as well taking measures. You see airports taking measures. You think in your mind, as you see the international response, is this sort of on track?
I would like to go back to the year 2003 during SARS. And I think we learned a lot from that episode. And there are visible progressions and measures being put in place in almost every country. But obviously, you know, at different stage of technological development. But I would say that every country has now realized the importance of preventive measures to overcome pandemics or overcome novel virus or novel infections. So if you look around the regions, you can see that there are reports from our regional countries, partners, reporting cases as well, which means that they do put in effort, they do put in the infrastructure and technology to be able to detect the infections.
Probably now is a good time to talk about individual behavior. I suppose it's human nature when you have so much information. And this, again, one thing that's different from 2003. Individuals now have so much information, there's social media, and that's helpful as well as sometimes unhelpful. And one of the areas in which we do get a lot of questions on is how to take care of ourselves as individuals. Let's start with basic hygiene. If everyone sort of adhered to the best standards of personal hygiene in terms of what Yingru was talking about, would the general person who is of good health, does he have to have extra concerns if already he sort of, you know, he washes his hands quite often, he sneezes into his elbows or whatever the case may be? Is that as it stands now more than sufficient or quite adequate to address people's fears?
I would think that this is a daily responsibility of individuals, not really just because we are responding to a new virus. Perhaps I just want to add on one point that is on influenza vaccination. Because now is influenza season, December, January is the peak seasons in Singapore. I just want to emphasize and encourage our public to really have serious considerations of influenza virus, because that reduces either the milder disease or it can prevent the infections.
And of therefore the milder disease.
Yeah, that's right. Influenza. In other words, we are able to reduce episodes of acute respiratory illness caused by influenza. And therefore, it also reduces personal worries because we are looking for fever, we are looking for respiratory symptoms. If we can protect yourself using vaccine, you basically reduce your chances of developing this acute respiratory illness. But I also want to emphasize the point that currently available influenza vaccine is not to protect this novel coronavirus, it's to protect influenza virus.
Yes. Would you say that the rates of vaccination for seasonal flu in Singapore, what are they like? Could they be much better?
Oh, I don't have the precise data, but just from a little bit of ground feedback that there are more people asking for influenza vaccine. So I just want to bring in this point that it shouldn't be a reaction things, but it's proactively being getting it done on a yearly basis.
Would you recommend it for everyone, do you think?
I would recommend, first of all, the at-risk populations, as well as the populations that we want to prevent, like for example healthcare workers, because you do not want situations where healthcare workers inadvertently could have transmitting the virus to the people they care for. I would first of all recommend that group. Whether we do universal influenza vaccinations, I think it's a different topic, but at least minimally we should be able to cover those that require the vaccine.
So basically the elderly,
those
young,
with chronic disease, and those people that we specifically focus on, pregnant ladies, healthcare workers.
Is there also something to be said if more people are vaccinated against the regular seasonal flu, you have fewer of them seeking help, fewer of them going to the GPs, fewer of them ending up in hospitals as well, which sort of frees up the hospitals to deal with the actual serious cases, whether it is the serious flu or the Wuhan virus?
In fact, that is the purpose of the recommendations of influenza vaccines. Because if you look at the local data that's available, it's very clear that the excess mortality happened during the influenza season in the local situation in Singapore too. So in other words, if we have high transmissions of influenza virus during middle of the year, end of the year, during these two periods, correspondingly, we are also seeing more deaths.
Interesting. Okay.
Largely because the health systems get stretched.
Exactly.
So we know that happens normally in the two flu seasons in Singapore. Now that we've got people coming with potentially novel coronavirus, this will also stretch the system. So people have to wait longer for tests. The emergency departments are busier. I wanted to bring it back to the severity of the novel coronavirus, because this is really critical in how we respond. We still don't know if it's going to be as severe as SARS, which had like a 10% mortality. Most of us think it won't be? Mm-hmm. Or is it more like a flu model?
Yeah. Which is what?
Which is where we're leaning. Mm-hmm. But we still don't know for sure. We know the case fatality rate is coming down each day, okay? So a few days ago it was 3.4%, then it was 2.8%. And that's because they're diagnosing more milder cases. So the case fatality rate is the number of deaths divided by the number of confirmed cases. But we know in China there's still another 6,000 suspect cases waiting for tests. So we can expect that case fatality rate to keep coming down, at least in my opinion.
Hopefully.
And if it is only the same mortality as flu, which is like one or two per thousand, then the sort of excesses in terms of the response can be more measured, I think.
You know, that's the reason why I asked the first question I did when we started our conversation, whether or not even at this stage we could situate it in comparison to a regular flu virus. Because you see this every year, healthcare authorities warning people not to take their eyes off the seasonal flu, not to take their eyes off the vaccinations, because people don't understand that this regular flu is actually quite serious as well. When you look at the novel coronavirus now, it's hopefully, as Dale said, trending towards that same mortality rate. If that's the case, then I suppose that's good news. Nisin?
Perhaps I hold a slightly different view over here, because it's still relatively a new condition. Sure. And if we were to diagnose milder case earlier, then I think we have to watch very carefully disease progressions, because it is a characteristic of coronavirus, for example, SARS, that disease progress over a period of time. And usually you'll start to see pneumonia round about maybe end of first week or so. And therefore, it is a little bit too premature, I think, to nail down what could be the case fatality rate. Although generally looking, it may look like it is lower than SARS. But at the same time, don't forget, because of the advancements of medical supporting treatment, and therefore that could also be one of the factors.
Why, yeah.
Right, why you see a final lower number of mortality. Finally, I just want to say that because it is new, it is novel virus, it is likely a zoonotic transmissions that gain momentum, human-to-human transmission.
Zoonotic as in from animals?
From animal to human. I'm still hoping that we can do something to prevent this virus taking root in the human or taking root in the community. I think this is a chance for us to do it. And the window period is actually very, very small. I would like to see that, you know, all efforts put in so that, you know, we can at least achieve that. If we miss this window opportunity, yes, we will come back.
Yes.
And discuss more.
I fully agree. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what's your position?
I think you know when we started off with a question of should you be confident when you sneeze into your elbow?
That still got to get back to that.
That you are helping yourself well. So yeah. I think people fear unknowns. Mm-hmm. Everyone is afraid of the unknown. So in this outbreak, there are a lot of unknowns which we just discussed here. But there are really concrete things people can do to protect themselves and their loved ones. And one of them is to provide information as soon as you have it. It's very, very important. That's maybe the most important thing. But then there's a lot of misinformation and rumors. So please,
precisely,
before you spread a rumor, ask someone who knows about it, or even contact WHO or the national authorities, the government, whether the information is correct before you spread the rumors on social media. And there's a lot you can do yourself to spread. And this is what Yasin just said, hand hygiene, respiratory hygiene, and also food safety.
Yeah.
That's very, very important. I just wanted to remind everyone.
So let me
get
to the topic that's taken the news in the last couple of days. That's the issue of masks. You see it being sold out everywhere, not just in Singapore, in other places as well, people queuing up for masks. Maybe each of you tell me what your perspective is on whether, who, and when to wear your mask, what the mask can actually do or what it can't. So maybe Yingru, start with you first.
Well, I'm not wearing a mask. I flew
None of us
from
actually, by the way,
Kuala Lumpur to Singapore yesterday, I observed there are a lot of masks.
Yeah.
So the WHO is recommending respiratory hygiene, protecting yourself from coughing into the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So the masks are reserved for the people who don't feel well, who are sick, who are coughing, to protect others. That's our recommendation. There are so many things you must do in addition wearing a mask. Wearing a mask alone is not sufficient
to
prevent
to
getting infected.
Your point there. So it is more to prevent others from being infected by whatever you have, rather than and as a defensive measure to protect yourselves from some unknown, in this case, the novel coronavirus. Dale?
I also don't own a mask, and neither does anyone in my family. Masks, I think, by and large, are a false sense of security in the community. Healthcare workers are trained how to use them, how to dispose of them properly, when to use them. I see a lot of people that might have a mask, that it might be on their forehead, it might be under their chin. I see people touch masks and then touch their eyes. Mm. So if you are going to wear a mask, you shouldn't touch it. You should remove it carefully and then you should wash your hands afterwards. If you do touch it, you should wash your hands because think about it. If you believe there is a respiratory virus on your mask outside. And then you touch it, it's now on your hand. Okay. Then you touch your face. It's now on your face. Then you shake hands with someone. They've now got it. So all this because people thought the mask was safe. I like to discourage masks in the community. I think they're excellent for the healthcare setting where trained people are looking after sick people.
Good point. He's in.
Well, I have to agree. I think a false sense of security possibly is worse.
So as it stands now, because I hear people say, and I wasn't actually in the country during SARS, I hear people tell me that, hey, you know, during SARS, there weren't that many people wearing masks as well. They couldn't comprehend the disjuncture there. I don't know. But again, I think it's because they have so much information, they feel insecure, they don't feel safe. And the only thing that they can do for themselves is just put on a mask, right? Better than nothing. So are we saying that actually in some circumstance, it's not just better than nothing, it is counterproductive? Do you think that can be said, Yisin?
I'm not too sure about any data or evidence to say whether or not it's productive or counterproductive. Mm. But on a practical term, I agree absolutely with Ingru and also Dale that there are many ways to protect some individuals. Mask is only one of them. And if the mask gives you false sense of security and you've forgotten about the rest that you need to do, then I think it will be a more potentially more worse situations.
May I interfere here?
Yeah.
I think in a situation, in a new novel outbreak situation, where the recommendation is that people who are sick or potentially sick should wear a mask and there are no masks available for them
to wear,
that could be counterproductive.
So that's the danger. I think that's where I think some of the messaging has come out that let's not overdo this now, overuse it now, because when the time comes when people really do need it, when it might be useful in preventing it, then it's not readily available.
It should be made available, but it's just a...
Could I also say you can only get it from someone who has it? So I see people driving
in the car
on their own wearing a mask.
Yeah.
I say, who are you going to get it from? There are rumours, this is droplet spread, so actually if you're 1 or 2 metres away from the person, that actually should be enough. We like to take more precautions, especially if we know. The fears of spread from asymptomatic people really did cause a lot of concern. To my knowledge, there's no verification of those. There's certainly rumours and statements by senior officials in China making that case. Mm. But this is another big unknown. We know in SARS and MERS there were asymptomatic people. So that was people you could find the virus on their throat, but they didn't have cough or anything like that. And we know already with the novel coronavirus that there are people without symptoms that can have it on their throat. But we don't believe they're infective. At least not significantly infective, because they're not coughing. I don't think we should be worried about asymptomatic people.
Yeah. As I begin to close off our discussion, it'll be a great discussion. Maybe one way to talk about it then, because we do get a sense as well, and again, people are so well informed these days. They see what Thailand is doing, they see what China is doing, they see what Malaysia is doing. Everyone gets this overload of information, and you do see sometimes national jurisdictions saying slightly different things from other countries, right? And if I'm a regular Joe, and you see a country X say, yes, put on a mask when you need to, whereas country B says, actually, you don't really need to. I sometimes sympathize for the people who may overreact or may seem to overreact. So in this particular case, maybe Yingru, just to end off, is the WHO going to take a stronger position on this? You know, we definitely like to see the WHO come out a little bit more in terms of its messaging that other countries can then sort of take reference from. Otherwise, if you have disparate messages, then other people can get confused as well.
So I think WHO has been coming out very strongly. That was actually the first message coming from WHO. There are 5 key roles WHO is playing in this. Number one is increasing an understanding of this disease and also how to prevent it. And this is really the hygiene, the hand hygiene, respiratory hygiene and food safety. The second one is providing advice. The third one is keeping countries informed, and that's also the people in the countries informed. The fourth one is coordinating with partners and experts. And the fifth one is helping countries to prepare.
Dale, last question for you, because you mentioned that the prospect of community spread is in some way inevitable, might possibly happen soon. How well do you think we're prepared, Singapore, both infrastructure as well as men on the street?
Thanks for that question.
You're welcome.
I think Singapore's extraordinary. It's prepared, it's practiced, it's got great experiences to pull on through SARS and H1N1. There's an incredible amount of talent in the ministry and in each hospital. We've got strong infectious disease teams and strong emergency departments. Most hospitals have got fever facilities in their emergency departments, lots of isolation beds. Mm-hmm. NCID, of course, I'll let Yi-Sin talk about, but it's impressive in anyone's language. I do understand the health systems of a number of countries. I don't believe there's a stronger one than Singapore.
Yi-Sin, if I could get your final word as well, if you could sort of put some meat into that optimism. If you say, you know, how was Singapore like in dealing with SARS in 2003? We are now here 2020. What was the key learning point that you say we as a system learn from that and actually have put in place already now?
Well, I wouldn't want to self-praise too much.
That's why I did it for you.
No, see it as praise. See it as public education.
I think one of the very fortunate things, at least from our perspective, is that we finally built the National Center for Infectious Disease that give the search capacity to be able to support the entire nation. Then I would also like to say that we are somehow fortunate enough that we moved into the building about a year ago. It gave us this opportunity and a time period for us to be very familiar with the working environment and to be able to mount a more effective response, so to say. Overall, I would say that there are a lot of lessons learned from SARS, and many of these, in fact, have put into our routine, building up the standard operating procedure to be able to help us to do this. So there are a lot of drawer plans in Singapore, and we are now taking it out from the drawer and testing out the effectiveness of all these drawer plans. So I like to say that for every outbreak is a challenge, and every outbreak we will learn a lot, and it's a learning curve, and it's a never complete learning process. We're still on the way to continuously improve ourselves.
Thank you very much, Professor Leo Yi-Sin, Professor Dale Fisher, Dr. Low Ying-Ru. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been The Heart of the Matter.